fantastic to see you all in this room for the session on what's the difference between democratic socialism and revolutionary socialism. My name is Liz. I am a member here in Melbourne and also assistant secretary of the Victorian Socialists. So I'll share, and then we'll have Jeremy do the introduction and then plenty of time for discussion. So in terms of our speaker, Jerem is a candidate for the Victorian Socialists in the seat of Corwell. He is long-time radical, someone who's been involved in many fights around the environment, against Pauline Hanson, for workers' rights, and he's also one of our, he is the industrial organiser for Socialist Alternative, so helps to try and build up the confidence of our members in the workplace, strategise about how to build the union, how to wage particular industrial battles and build up support for radical politics in the workplace. So that's Jeremy. He'll speak for about half an hour and then we'll have time for discussion. Jeremy.
All right. Thank you. Okay, well, in some ways, it might seem a bit strange to be talking about what's the difference between revolutionary socialism and democratic socialism for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because as far as I'm concerned, revolution is the most democratic thing out. Like, for the vast majority of humanity, to forcibly impose our will on the world and, you know, stop the money bags from running everything, this is a profound exercise and extension of democracy. Second reason why it might be a little bit strange is because, as Liz mentioned, I'm running for office as a candidate for the Victorian Socialists, and as I'm sure all of you have read the Constitution of the Victorian Socialists, and so would be aware that we declare ourselves to be a democratic socialist organisation. I see no contradiction in that, despite being, you know, like a many decades long revolutionary. So I could sort of have one angel on one shoulder, you know, sort of slugging it out, democracy versus revolution. I guess, you know, spoiler alert, like, it's democratic socialism necessary, worthwhile, worth supporting, but certainly not sufficient for the sort of changes that we need. I wanted to spend the first part of my talk outlining the case for revolutionary socialism before getting into, you know, different versions of socialism, some history and so on. And I guess I can assume a fair bit of common ground here, but I think it's worth spelling out. I've got 14 sort of overlapping elements that make up a revolutionary socialist worldview. And item one on that, of course, would be the critique of capitalism as a system that can't be fundamentally reformed. Don't know whether people have seen the Naomi Klein movie, The Corporation, where she has the FBI definition of a psychopath and compares that to the ethos, makeup and behaviour of the modern corporation. No compunction, recklessness with the truth, ruthless disregard for the welfare of others. Like, she takes you through each of those FBI checkpoints and concludes the main way that we organise production in our society is psychopathic. It is actually, like, totally inhuman. Now, okay, you can get a better healthcare system if you fight for it and if the system can afford it. You can't do away with that fundamentally psychopathic nature of the system that we live under. If we could point to just one war that's been a product of capitalism, or one instance of racism, or one instance of enslavement, or one instance of oppression, because, oh, well, that's a bit of a hiccup in the system. When these wars and oppressions keep on happening and keep on happening, decade after decade, actually century after century, we have to say this is not some bug in the system. This is a design feature of capitalism. Capitalism depends on these things, and you cannot reform them out of capitalism. You have to do away with the system entirely. Part of the critique of capitalism, of course, is a profound lack of democracy. You know, the traditional complaint of the social democratic government. You know, we were in government, but we weren't in power. We tried to implement progressive reforms. There was a run on the dollar or the pound or whatever. The money bags withdrew their investments, and we had to capitulate. That unelected power of the top of Collins Street or Peppermint Grove or, you know, wherever the hell it is, you know, there's this thing called the economy, which is totally outside of any democratic control. I don't know about you, I missed the vote where we voted to have Rupert Murdoch own most of our media, or for Mark Zuckerberg to run, you know, how visible left-wing websites are, you know, on Facebook or whatever. Like, there's a myriad things in our society which are totally outside of democratic control. And so, yeah, fundamentally, there's serious limits on the extent to which you can win reforms under capitalism, let alone, you know, and you simply cannot reform the exploitation and oppression which is at the heart of the capitalist system. So that's number one point in a revolutionary socialist worldview. Number two, of course, is that humanity can do much better than this. Like capitalism, even class society has only been around for a few thousands of years. Humans have been around for hundreds of thousands. You know, there's no necessary reason why we have to live in this, you know, like class-dominated system that we live under. Number three, that there exists a body of people in modern society, the, basically those of us who have to work for a living, the working class that has no interest in the capitalist system, its wars, its oppression, its exploitation, or anything else about it. And number four, that that body, the working class, actually has the power to do away with the capitalist system, mainly because we do all the goddamn work. Partly also because capitalism organises us into workplaces, into industries, into cities, and then subjects us to economic crisis, to wars, you know, and other political events that can radicalise people and lead to a revolutionary crisis. So that revolution, you know, that revolution is possible. Number five, the revolutionary rupture is needed to do away with capitalist power because the capitalists aren't just going to say, oh, well, okay, we've had our turn, you know, stuffed a few things up, oh, well, over to you. Like, you actually need a revolutionary seizure of power. Argument number six in the revolutionary socialist worldview, it's not just because the money bags won't surrender all of their control. We need a revolution for us. Karl Marx talked about the working class makes ourselves fit to govern in the struggle to govern. It's in the process of uniting and overcoming all of that oppression and exploitation that we get rid of, you know, what he called the muck of ages, all the sexism, all of the, you know, shit that we you know, are affected by in capitalist society and so on. We need a revolution for that. Number seven, that the logic of working class struggle points in the direction of collective ownership of the means of production. Like, if we all decide that we're going to take over some means of production, even some piss-out little means of production like a McDonald's store, there's no point in me owning the chip fryer and Liz here owning the air conditioning system and the person in the front row owning the front doors, and we all sort of, you know, barter and exchange the values of these things. Like, it makes no sense. Any modern means of production can only be held collectively. Like, if the working class is to succeed, you know, in overcoming the capitalists, it points the way to a fundamental reorganisation of society on the basis of collective ownership. And that we've seen that. Well, and that flows into number eight, that the working class basically has to start from scratch in creating its own organs of government. And you see this emerge at all of the high points of working class struggle. In the Paris Commune in 1871, in the Russian Revolution of 1917, in the Hungarian Revolt, in the Polish Revolt of 1980, you know, glimmers of it in France in 1968. Wherever the working class, you know, gets a move on and actually says, okay, we are imposing our will, these forms of organisations, whether you call them Soviets, councils, shuras, cordones, you know, depending on what the part of the world, start to emerge. Those are the organs of working class power that are necessary and possible for a revolution. Number nine, I suppose the flip side of that, the old state has to be destroyed. It's not enough just to set up our own very democratic, participatory, flexible organisations, as revolutionaries and the working class have done many times. It's not enough just to sort of, you know, like put the state back in its box. You actually have to dismantle it. The repressive core of the state, the police has to be disbanded. The rank and file of the army has to be won over. If they're left to just do their own thing and we do ours, sooner or later they will do us over. So you have to destroy the old capitalist state and the guts of it. Number 10, of course, implied in that is a sharp break in capitalist legality. If we want to seize the assets of the super rich, I think the courts might have something to say about that. If we disband the courts or just appoint new judges, I think the army might have something to say about that. So you very quickly run into the need to, you know, to push through the sort of capitalist legal straitjacket which politics and the economy and society operates in this society. Number 11, that socialism in one country is impossible. Capitalism is a worldwide system. Its replacement also has to be a worldwide system. So socialists, revolutionary socialists, are fundamentally internationalists. Yes, the working class will be able to seize power in one country. Unless that very rapidly spreads, it will be overcome in one way or another. Another point is that, I suppose it's sort of expanding on another point, revolution is not only necessary, but it's possible. Revolutionary change comes in waves. Even in my lifetime, which is longer than some here, but it's not that long, 1989, like, you know, generations of people had grown up under the system, just thinking, grown up under the Stalinist system in Russia, just thinking, okay, this is the way it is, nothing will ever change, you can't change anything. It was a wave of revolutions that did away with those Stalinist obscenities masquerading as socialism in 1989 through to 1991. 2003, the world's largest coordinated, wasn't a revolutionary way, but the world's largest coordinated protest action ever. Happened not back in the dim, distant past, happened in 2003 in response to the US invasion of Iraq. The anti-globalisation movement in the late 1990s, again, didn't rise to revolutionary heights, but a very significant wave of struggle and radicalisation that affected many parts of the world and even washed up here in sleepy old Melbourne at the S11 protests in 2000. And of course, most recently, from 2011, a sharp response to the economic crisis affecting North Africa, the Middle East, toppled the regimes in Egypt, jumped across the Mediterranean, people in Greece were affected by the, great financial crisis as well. We seem to be able to topple governments by sitting in the middle of the square for a few months. So there was this movement of the squares in Greece. From there, it spreads to Spain. From Spain, it jumps across the Atlantic to New York. And, of course, from New York, it sort of metastasizes. It goes to 154 different cities around the world in the form of the global Occupy movement. Now, in most places, outside of Egypt, Tunisia, and a couple of other places, that struggle didn't reach revolutionary proportions. Here in Australia, we basically sailed through the economic crisis. But that's an example of the sort of, wave of struggle that capitalism produces. Despite all their plans and schemes, their control of the media and all the rest of it, it produces these crises, which, and the outcome of those waves of struggle, depends not just on objective conditions, but in very large part on how well we're organised. So that's point number 13, the need for organisation. We're in the fight of our lives, and we're up against an extremely formidable enemy, not just the capitalist class, but the representatives of the capitalist system within the workers' movement. It'd be pretty easy if we were fighting just the capitalists. But it's actually the people who head up the trade unions, who head up the Labor Party, who, when one of those waves of struggle hits, says, OK, well, let's divert that, let's channel that, let's try to pacify that wave of struggle rather than mounting any sort of fundamental challenge to the system. So if we want a different outcome from that, well, revolutionaries actually have to be organised well in advance. And point number 14, and probably the most obvious at all, if you haven't picked it up by now, it's a matter of self-organisation. The emancipation of the working class, as Marx once wrote, is the act of the working class itself. And, our entire politics, organisation, worldview is centred around that belief. Okay. So a couple of things from this, easy 14-point programme for revolutionary change. Got it all down pat. Out we go. But a couple of things should be pretty clear. First of all, what I mentioned at the start of the talk, that revolutionary change involves, shouldn't be counterposed to democracy. Like, it involves a vast extension of democracy into the economy, abolishing the undemocratic capitalist state and having a much more flexible, accountable, participatory approach to organising human affairs. When we look at... So what are we talking about? Well, we talk about democratic socialism. We're not... the people that use, in common parlance, democratic socialism, they don't mean revolutionary socialism in the way that I've just outlined. There can be some people that sort of use democratic socialism as a counterpoint, I suppose, to the Stalinist obscenities that masqueraded as socialism for a few generations. But much more, the use of democratic socialism as a phrase has been popularised by Bernie Sanders especially, and a range, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other democratic socialists in the United States who say, yes, we are democratic socialists. So I think it's worth having a look at how many of that 14-point checklist Bernie Sanders actually agrees with. And you won't find one. Bernie Sanders is a very important figure in United States politics and therefore in world politics. It's of incredible significance that you have a national political figure talking about universal healthcare, talking about the toxic waste dumps that affect communities of colour, talking about, talking up teachers' strikes. What else have I seen, just in the last week? Against the murderous war in Yemen and the United States, fueling that war by supplying guns to Saudi Arabia. All of this is progressive. All of this is supportable. It's not socialist. We all celebrated when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, got her, won her primary, and all celebrated the fact that the Merriam-Webster Dictionary puts out one of their sort of self-serving press releases saying there's been a 1,500% increase in the number of people looking up socialism on the Merriam-Webster Dictionary since AOC won her primary. Now, I don't know whether Matthias is here, but a member of my branch actually went to the trouble of looking up the Merriam-Webster Dictionary definition of socialism, and it reads like this. 1. Any of various economic and political theories advocating collective or governmental ownership and administration of the means of production and distribution of goods. That's the dictionary definition of socialism. That's not what Bernie Sanders stands for, or AOC for that matter. In February this year, where's he gone? Bernie Sanders said, "When I use the word socialist, and I know some people aren't comfortable about it, I'm saying that it is imperative that we create a government that works for all and not the few. I don't believe government should own the means of production, but I do believe that the middle class and the working families who produce the wealth of America deserve a fair deal." Now, yeah, okay. So, like, and, you know, I was sort of struggling through that 14-point list. Is there even one that Bernie, like, you know, and we don't want to take away from the significance of Bernie Sanders and the shift that's going on in US politics, the disgust within the neoliberal mainstream. But I think the question is, what are the differences between democratic socialism and revolutionary socialism? Democratic socialism, as it's used by Bernie Sanders, meets not one of those criteria. He doesn't, you know, he wants a better deal for families out of the existing setup. He doesn't want to abolish the system of government in the United States, let alone replace it with a much more flexible and democratic system of workers' councils. He doesn't want to, doesn't want collective or government ownership of the means of production. And I think there's one area which it's quite important for revolutionary socialists to highlight in terms of Bernie's politics, which is imperialism. And if you look at what Bernie has said over a long period of time, like the great emerging imperialist rivalry in the world today is the United States versus China. And you look at what Bernie has to say about that, it's all about, let's take our jobs back from China. China has to be stopped from arming. We have to contain China. You know, like there's actually not a lot of difference in terms of program between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. If you look at what they actually say, Bernie Sanders doesn't do it with a bombast, you know, that Trump does, but his actual program isn't so different. And we have to remember, like, it's quite possible to have a progressive domestic agenda about we want workers to have higher wages, we want, to eliminate poverty and so on, while pursuing imperialist war. And there's examples of that in the Democratic Party. Roosevelt, FDR, you know, back in the 30s, you know, the New Deal at home, and yeah, we've got to get into this imperialist carve-up of the world, the most brutal slaughter known in human history, which was known as World War II. LBJ, Johnson, you know, the Great Society at home, while he escalates this murderous war in Vietnam. So we don't want to fall into the trap of just saying, okay, $15 in a decent healthcare system equals socialism. It doesn't. It's far from equaling socialism. So, like, yeah, okay. Where are we? There are a bunch of writers, and I can't do justice to, to any of them, actually, but I can't even talk about most of them. A bunch of writers around Jacobin, the very prominent left-wing and very, you know, like, useful in different ways, left-wing website and newspaper, or magazine, rather, from the United States. And a bunch of these people, you know, they're not like Bernie Sanders. Like, they would actually tick number one, you know, critique of socialism as a fundamentally, critique of capitalism as a fundamentally, exploitative system that has to be overcome. Like, a lot of these people are actually socialists, and not just, you know, some softer, milder version, like a sort of social democrat version. And they're worth looking at. One of them that I'll spend a few minutes sort of going through is Vivek Chiba, and there was, I think Daniel was kind enough to send me an exchange between Chiba and Charlie Post, a well-known US Marxist historian and theorist, on the pages of Jacobin about a year ago. And Chiba's argument is, yes, we need socialism, yes, we need the working class in control, yes, for that, actually, we need a cater centralised party as well. Like, you know, we've got a lot of common ground with Vivek Chiba. But then he goes on to say, in his words, that it's entirely hallucinatory to think about socialism through the lens of the Russian Revolution, through the lens of a revolutionary upsurge. And he says, the state has infinitely greater legitimacy with the population than European states did a century ago. Further, its coercive power, its power of surveillance, and the ruling class's internal cohesiveness give the social order a stability that is orders of magnitude greater than it had in 1917. What that means is, while we can allow for and perhaps hope for the emergence of revolutionary conditions where the state breakdown is really on the cards, we can't build a political strategy around it as an expectation, and we can't take it as the left's fundamental strategic perspective. So revolution basically goes on the back burner or into the fridge, it's there if we need it, but in the realm of practical politics, really we're excluding it. And Chipper goes on. Our strategic perspective has to downplay the centrality of a revolutionary rupture and navigate a more gradualist approach. For the foreseeable future, left strategy has to revolve around building a movement to pressure the state, gain power within it, change the institutional structure of capitalism, and erode the structural power of capital, rather than vaulting over it. Okay. So if you wanted to critique this, you could take it from a few angles. One is, logic. There's straight away a bit of a contradiction there. Like, on the one hand, Chipper is saying capitalism is so powerful that you can't overcome it with a revolution. On the other hand, capitalism will allow its structural power to be eroded by left forces. Like, this, to me, just seems hallucinatory if we're talking about an actual change in the system to socialism. I think what's actually going on here is a profound pessimism about the prospects, even in the long term, for revolution, so let's just lower our sights. I don't think Chipper is the first, Chipper is definitely not the first theorist in history, and I'll talk about another in a bit, we chuck out revolution, chuck that out the window, but out with it actually goes the end goal of socialism. Chipper's attitude to the state. The state has been constructed over centuries to serve the interests of the capitalist class. Like, yes, it's a site of struggle, I guess you could say, but it's one profoundly hostile to socialists. You know, we have to go into its institutions, such as Parliament, realising, like, we are totally surrounded by hostile forces and the most meaningful revolutionary activity, any revolutionary activity, will not happen within the state. You know, far from, marching through the institutions of the state, changing the institutional structure of capitalism through it, and so on. One important part of that critique is what Charlie Post points out. The nature of working class struggle is episodic. You know, you can't stay at this, point of revolutionary, activity for year upon year upon year. Unless you use that moment to actually abolish the state and establish a new one, the moment will pass and the old state forces will come back. So it seems quite hallucinatory to expect the institutional forms to survive within the capitalist state, the institutional forms of socialism. You could quibble with other things in Chipper's argument. I mean, it's obviously true. There has been no revolutionary crisis affecting Western societies anywhere near as severe as those that gripped it 100 years ago in the dying days of what was then the greatest slaughter that had ever been seen, World War I, in the years that followed that. If you drew the baseline maybe 20 years earlier, you wouldn't find the same degree of delegitimisation of the state. Wars are one of the things that create these waves of radicalisation that discredit the state, that destabilise it, and that can create revolutionary opportunities. I think second last thing on Chipper. He talks about sort of putting revolutionary politics on the back burner or in the fridge. The problem is that revolutionary politics doesn't do so well on the back burner, and it really doesn't keep well in the fridge. Like, this is not to say that, we are going to be leading revolutions, today or even in the near future. But unless you emphasise in the worldview that you're winning people to and in that you're acting according to, unless you emphasise contempt for the capitalist class, contempt for the capitalist rules, for their laws, for their political institutions, unless you see these as hostile institutions that actually have to be overthrown, if and when a revolutionary crisis, as envisaged by Chipper, arises, you will be incapable of acting in order to push that along. And finally, Chipper, he actually talks about the limits of social democracy. So he himself notes, social democracy was a spent force by the 1980s. Its parties degenerated into a managerial ethos. The reformist agenda was halted and then reversed and had proven to be largely uninterested in revitalising their own legacy. For this phenomenon to be so widespread and so pervasive means that it can't have been because of individual failings and treachery. There was something structural behind it. And this means, in turn, that the left needs to understand the structural roots of the failure to at least have a fighting chance of avoiding the same fate, full stop. All of which is fine, except the full stop. Like, what was going on there was social democracy attempting to govern a system, capitalism, that demands exploitation, war, and sacrifice. Like, if you want to govern that system, you have to play according to capitalist rules. You have to keep the psychopaths happy, basically. And he simply doesn't draw that conclusion. Okay. Doesn't matter. We're all socialists, you, me, Bernie Sanders, Vivek Chiba, we're all socialists, you know. Surely we should just emphasise what we agree on and concentrate on that and work on that. And the rest will sort of work itself out. There's a few problems with this. Number one, if we actually mean by socialism the vast majority of humanity consciously seizing control over our fate and over our planet, we have to be bloody conscious of what we're doing. We're not going to sleepwalk into it. We're not just going to extrapolate from what we're doing. Like, there are going to be serious arguments that have to happen. Developing actually revolutionary consciousness is an important part of it. Where you end up depends in large measure on what direction you head in. You know, if you're heading towards the lofty heights of revolutionary socialism, okay, that's one thing. If you're pointing in a totally other direction, you're never going to get to that destination. The one job that revolutionary socialists take pretty seriously is critiquing other versions of socialism. It was really important for us. For decades, there's a tendency to critique the obscenities masquerading as socialism that was Stalinism. You know, and it was like extremely fortunate that there was a group of people who did that and didn't just say, oh, let's all get along and concentrate on what we agree on, when those Stalinist tyrannies were overthrown by the people that they'd been oppressing. And, you know, like on a less dramatic scale, like the socialist credentials of someone like Daniel Andrews, who's part of the socialist left, like distinguishing between, you know, what we would regard as an authentic, as a plausible, version of socialism and a means to attain it, and, you know, like various inadequate, takes on it, is pretty crucial. Okay. So I can sort of argue from, you know, point of view of logic or whatever, that yes, it matters. I want to take you through, if I can show my extremely dull slides, mainly consisting of blokes with beards. So there's been quite an exchange on Jacobin over the last year, but, you know, intensifying over the last few months, about goings-on in what at that time was the largest avowedly socialist party in the world about 100 years ago, the German Social Democratic Party. And there's a couple of talks where, you know, at this conference where people will be talking about Kautsky, where people will be talking about, the fate of German reformism and so on. I'm a bit of an unlikely candidate to sort of kick off the Kautsky wars at this particular conference. Like, I've read a biography of, you know, a couple of the key players or whatever. So I'll just sort of take you through it. Okay. I think you've probably met these two guys with beards, Marx and Engels. Intellectual, organisational, political, originators of modern revolutionary socialism. And, of course, one of the most famous statements is our aims at the end of their Communist Manifesto, our aims will only be achieved by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. It's pretty comprehensive. The working class has nothing to lose but their chains. The ideas of Marx and Engels, of course, informed the founders and the leaders of the German Social Democratic Party through the 1870s and through the 1880s. Can I get the next one? They developed, a very sizable social democratic party, avowedly, yes, we're headed for revolution, nothing to lose but our chains. Over the course of a couple of decades, though, all of a sudden they have not one newspaper but dozens. They have not one party branch but, you know, thousands across Germany. They have a bureaucracy, they have newspaper editors, they have members of parliament, and especially they have trade union leaders. All of these people found that maybe actually we do have something to lose but our chains. They have their standing in society, they have their institutions that they've so, you know, painfully built up. And out of the growing sort of self-consciousness of that layer, that leading layer within the Social Democratic Party, came, excuse me, a brand of Marxist thought disparagingly referred to as revisionism, because it was a revision of Marx and Engels. It was headed by this guy, Edward Bernstein. And he was basically, look, I'm a Marxist, you know, great analysis, all the rest of it, but, like, you know, there's not going to be this revolutionary crisis. Just basically, maybe we should just concentrate on, you know, what was Chibber's phrase? Like, basically eroding the power of the state, instituting reforms that will eventually, in some unspecified way, lead to the institution of capitalism, institution of socialism. This is a very long and many-sided debate, many protagonists on both sides. This is one of the more famous ones on the revolutionary side, Rosa Luxemburg. And she ridiculed Bernstein's assertions that passing reform bills alone could overcome capitalism. A quote from her. Legislative reform and revolution are not different methods of historic development that can be picked out at pleasure from the counter of history, just as one chooses hot or cold sausages. She points out, every legal constitution is a product of a revolution. Work for reforms is carried on only in the framework of the social form created by the last revolution. Here is the kernel of the problem. So basically she's saying, okay, if you contain yourself within capitalist legality, going through the capitalist parliamentary system, you will be contained within the system of capitalism. Reforms can only reach set limits which are set by the existing social system. So reforming capitalism out of existence is a nonsense. And she concluded one of her famous polemics on this. That is why people who pronounce themselves in favour of the method of legislative reform in place of social revolution do not really choose a more tranquil, calmer and slower road to the same goal, but a different goal. Instead of taking a stand for the establishment of a new society, they take a stand for surface modifications of the old society. Now, in this particular debate against Bernstein, she was joined by probably, you know, the most famous theorist of Marxism after Marx and Engels, which is this fellow Karl Kautsky. Who wrote many learned treatises on just how wrong Bernstein was, how he was betraying the spirit of Marx and Engels, and so on. The thing about Kautsky was, though, he was the sort of in-between guy. Like, yes, you know, we've got to stick to the letter of what Marx and Engels wrote, but we have to keep this party together. And so, in practice, that started to amount to a left-wing rhetorical gloss on what was an increasingly right-wing political practice of the German Social Democrats. He actually coined a phrase for this called centrism. Now, all of these last three, they're all socialists. They're all on the same side. They want socialism. You know, they're a big step up on Bernie Sanders. So what's the problem? Surely they should just all get along and we should concentrate on what we agree on. Well, okay. Three crucial tests that that these three lived through. Test number one, I might as well have the picture. There you go. Choose what team you're on, I suppose. Doesn't get any more dramatic than that. I'm sorry. Yeah. Crucial test number one, though, is imperialist war breaks out, World War One. Bernstein is the guy who says, well, okay, I know we had that whole line in the Second International and the German Social Democrats, the workers of the world were meant to go out on strike, stop the war from happening. That doesn't really seem to be on the cards. Look, we're going to get outlawed, we're going to lose everything if we take that stand, so we just have to go with the flow for a little bit and vote for the war credits in the German parliament. That was Bernstein. Rosa Luxemburg, of course, opposed. Said, no, this is a total betrayal of everything that we stood for the Social Democrats, forever. Kautsky was the guy who initially supported Rosa's position, and then, like, once he worked out which way the vote was going, it's like, oh, God, okay, we need to sort of somehow keep things together. That's the main thing that we need to do. So, okay, we'll vote for the war credits, but let's add a caveat on that, saying that they're not to be used for a war of occupation, only for a war of defence. Like, this is while German soldiers are marching through Belgium into France, you know? So it's basically left cover on an appalling, you know, betrayal of the working class. That's test number one. Test number two is the mass strike debate, which is a very long-running debate in German social democracy. When the 1905 revolution broke out in Russia, the largest at that time and most spectacular strike movement that the world had ever seen. It reached insurrectionary proportions in centres, well, many centres actually, but including St. Petersburg and Moscow. Rosa Luxemburg hailed this, this is the future. This is what the revolution looks like. You know, workers, you know, through their own activity, throwing the system into chaos, asserting themselves, you know, rewriting the rules. You know, this is what the revolution, this is a phenomenal form of the social revolution. That was her line. Bernstein, of course, ran in fright. Kautsky came up with just a little bit of a middle position on the mass strike. He was actually on Rosa Luxemburg's side in 1905. But you've got to keep the party together. It involves a lot of trade union leaders. So let's come up with a compromise where, okay, in theory, the mass strike is a legitimate weapon of the class struggle that should not be discounted. In practice, though, let's do a secret deal with the trade union leaders that effectively ensure that the mass strike will never happen. And yes, 1905, well, it was all a bit, Bernstein's position was, yeah, basically, it should never happen except when it's carefully prepared, thought out, and so on. Kautsky had a version of that too. The whole thing about 1905 was that it wasn't thought out. It was this, you know, incredible, spontaneous uprising of the working class. And test number three is the test of power. The greatest slaughter that at that point had been known to humanity came to an end with the Russian Revolution in 1917 and revolution in Germany in 1918. And in the you know, few months that followed, well, Rosa Luxemburg ended up dead, killed by the forces of counter-revolution led by the Social Democrats, authorised by the Social Democrats, authorised by... you know, Bernstein was out of the party at that time, but people of Bernstein's ilk, and he quickly found his way back into the party. And once again, Kautsky was the middle guy. Oh, look, yes, okay, we need to preserve parliamentary democracy, but maybe we want some Soviets on the side. And it's these sort of debates which are being replayed again in the pages of Jacobin. They mattered a hell of a lot 100 years ago, and they're going to matter a hell of a lot in the circumstances which we'll be facing in the near future. Okay, I should finish up just by observing, like, we may as well get rid of these three. Well, yeah, except it's a matter of which team do you want to be on, I suppose. This doesn't exhaust the topic. Like, I think revolutionary socialists do want to draw very clear lines. What do we mean by socialism? How is it going to be achieved? You know, what's realistic and what's not? Having drawn those lines, there's a separate question which arises. How do revolutionary socialists relate to democratic socialist forces? How do we? It's a perpetual question in politics. How do we relate to emerging forces on our right? How do we intervene into that? What debates do we have? How do we intersect with that? How do we, you know, try to peel people off further to the left? That isn't really what this... I mean, it's what we end up talking about in these discussions. There's another session straight after this on can the left take over the Democratic Party, which is, you know, probably maybe a more appropriate forum to sort of thrash through you know, the sort of strategy and tactics of revolutionaries relating to so-called democratic socialists. But I think what answers we get to that question will depend very much on the answers that we give to the more fundamental questions about what socialism is and how it can be achieved. So I'll leave it there.